Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, February 24th. And you see I have the schedule up there, and we have a few lectures left before we can take the next test. So I can't imagine that we're not going to have the test next week anytime, okay? I'll try to get the study guides out to you as soon as possible. Okay, so I don't know if that will happen today or tonight, maybe tomorrow sometime. I can get the next couple chapters to you. All right, so that's just the way it goes, but you still got to be reading along in the textbook and studying all of this stuff. I can maybe squeeze the nervous system from three lectures down to two, maybe make up a little time right here. We'll see how that goes. But anyway, that's where we're going to start today with the nervous system. Well, it will not be next week. That's the only thing I know for sure. All right, so maybe toward the end of this week I'll have a much better idea if it will be Tuesday, 2 weeks from today, or Thursday, 2 weeks, okay? Okay. All right, but my plan is still to have the next test over chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. Is that right? Four enzymes, five cell respiration, seven nervous system, and autonomic nervous system. Right. 4, 5, 7, and 9. Yeah, and you had a question. You know, I post them as soon as I get them done. So I got them done just minutes before I sent them to you. Okay, because I'm reworking it for the new textbook that we have this semester. Otherwise, I would. I have a previous semester, but they're not quite the same. And it's maybe not worth your time to look at the previous semester's notes. Okay. Okay, so let me go get the lecture for today. Let me go get the lecture for today. All right, that looks good. All right, so what kind of questions might you have on cellular respiration? What's the purpose of cellular respiration? Yeah, just to make ATP. And now you know a lot of ways to do that. What are some ways that you could break the production of ATP down into two parts, two ways of thinking about cellular respiration? Aerobic versus anaerobic. Yeah, I like that a lot. Okay, what's another way you could break it down into two ways other than aerobic versus anaerobic that we talked about? I'm not sure I can hear you back there. How about substrate level versus oxidative phosphorylation? That's another way you could break it down into two different divisions, right? And where does oxidative phosphorylation take place? Yeah, electron transport chain, or I could ask you what organelle it takes place in, and you would say mitochondria. And what about substrate level phosphorylation? What metabolic pathways produce ATP by substrate level phosphorylation? Glycolysis is one. And there's another. I'm trying to do a couple of things here at one time. The Krebs cycle. Yeah, there's one step within the Krebs cycle that produces GTP. That is substrate level phosphorylation as well in the Krebs cycle. So where does glycolysis take place? Cytosol. Where does Krebs cycle take place? In the mitochondria. That's right. And the Krebs cycle, is that dependent on oxygen? Is that aerobic, part of aerobic pathway or anaerobic pathway? Aerobic pathway, that's right. So substrate level phosphorylation can take place in under anaerobic conditions or aerobic, depending on exactly where it is. All right, so that's some ways to think of all that. Where does beta oxidation take place? Where and under what conditions? Aerobic conditions, that's right. The name kind of gives it away, oxidation. And where does it take place? In mitochondria. Okay, so that's just a little synopsis of some things. Okay, so chapter 7 has a lot of review from your anatomy class in it that I'll expect you to know, and that is the structure of various neurons, what they look like, and what their function is. So that's the first part of this chapter, right? We're going to just talk about the nervous system, neurons, and supporting cells. What's another name for a supporting cell? Neuroglia cell. And then there are various kinds of neuroglia that you have to know about by their structure and their function and where they're found within the nervous system as well. So I'll go over this pretty quickly because it's just a review so we can get into membrane potentials and actually look and see how neurons do their job. All right, so don't forget we can divide the nervous system into central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. That's one nice way of doing that just by location in your body. So don't forget, what are the two parts that make up central nervous system? That is your brain and spinal cord, right? And then peripheral nerves are everything outside the brain and spinal cord, including cranial nerves and spinal nerves. These have exited the central nervous system. All right, there are two kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue. This is back from anatomy. You have neurons. Oh, my cursor is probably going to go away, so let me fix that right away. All right, there are neurons, and there are supporting cells that we call neuroglia or glial cells. And for many, many years, people were only interested in neurons because those were the cells that everybody thought were really controlling the nervous system. And of course, they're very important because they can transmit information over long distances very, very quickly because they can send information as electrical signals, electrical impulses that travel down an axon. Okay, so the functional units of the nervous system are neurons. All right, and I suppose you could put the emphasis on neurons, but we can't forget about how important glial cells are because they really help maintain the homeostasis of the nervous system. They support, they maintain the health of neurons. And as a matter of fact, they probably tell neurons how they should go about doing their business, how they should make connections with other kinds of neurons. And indeed, there are at least five times as many neuroglia cells compared to neurons in your nervous system. All right, so let's look at the first kind of cell first. They gather and transmit information, right, by accepting stimuli and responding to them. They then produce and send electrochemical impulses, and they can also release chemical messengers. Anybody know the name, the general name of a chemical messenger that a neuron can release or secrete? A neurotransmitter is a great example of that. That's a nice general name. And later on, we're going to know some specific names of neurotransmitters, but you probably already know some specific names. For instance, give me the name of a neurotransmitter that you're probably familiar with already. Okay, norepinephrine, maybe acetylcholine you learned about in anatomy, and there's numerous others. Some amino acids are neurotransmitters, like glycine and gamma-aminobutyric acid. We'll see what functions these play in the nervous system toward the end of the chapter. All right, so don't forget, a neuron has a cell body. It's got dendrites and it's got an axon. So this one right here is what we call, anybody recognize this neuron right here? How would you talk about the shape of this neuron right here? The shape. This would be a multipolar neuron. All right, and what kind of function does a multipolar neuron play in our bodies? Yeah, it's a motor neuron, right? So motor neuron means it's taking electrical signals away from our central nervous system to our periphery someplace. And you might recognize this one down over here. This is a unipolar neuron. And what kind of function does a unipolar neuron play in our bodies? It's a sensory neuron, right? So this is bringing information from the periphery into the central nervous system. So if you're not really familiar with that, you can read our text or go back to your anatomy book that I'm sure you guys have all really familiar with, and it'll probably come back to you pretty quickly. All right, so all the pieces of various kinds of neurons. Oh, and there's one kind of neuron that's not on this slide that you should be familiar with too, and that is a bipolar, and that's a special sensory neuron. So we might have those in our eyes and in our ears. Okay, it's a special kind of neuron for special senses. All right, so what are some of the pieces of an urn? We got these dendrites here. These are small, short processes. These receive signals from other neurons. We have the cell body, which contains the large manufacturing apparatus for neurotransmitters, but it also contains the nucleus and the apparatus for any kind of protein synthesis that has to take place in a neuron, so it's an enlarged area. This is also a part of the receiving part of a neuron. This receives information. And then the sending part of a neuron is the axon right here. It's a very long projection, and here is the axon terminus, and it can even branch and form collaterals, and so information is sent via this axon to these axon terminuses, and the axon terminus has an enlargement we call the bouton terminale or synaptic terminal or terminal button. This is where the neurotransmitters are stored before release across the synapse. All right, so information flow, this is a good place to think of, to start thinking. Information flow flows from dendrite to cell body, down an axon to an axon terminus. And it should be, you should consider that a one-way street, right? So electrical information flows in that direction. It doesn't flow the reverse. It doesn't come from an axon terminus up into the cell body and then out a dendrite. It can only flow in one direction. That's why neurons can either be motor or sensory, but they can't be both because electrical signals can only move in one direction. All right, with this unipolar neuron, these are the dendrites. These receive signals that send the signals up through. This is what we call the peripheral process because it's in your periphery, and then the cell bodies are in the dorsal root ganglia of the spinal cord, and then the central process, we call this, why do we call this the central process of this axon, of this unipolar neuron? Because it actually goes into the central nervous system, right? It goes into the central nerve. So this is the central process. Okay. All right, so that's some things about neurons. Groups of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system are what we call a nucleus. All right, like the basal nuclei are groups of these nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system. Now, these cell bodies of this unipolar neuron are in the peripheral nervous system. We don't call that a nucleus. We call that a ganglion, right, like the dorsal root ganglion, for instance. So a ganglion and a nucleus are very similar. The only difference is one is located in the CNS and the other is located in the PNS, peripheral nervous system. Okay. Okay, so dendrites receive information, and they convey that information to the cell body because they have ligand-gated channels. I don't think you really know exactly what that is yet. We're going to start talking about that, so you're going to have to come back and review this slide. All right. So dendrites and cell bodies have ligand-gated channels, but what can a channel do? What can a channel do in a membrane? It allows for transport of some material across the cell membrane that can't normally happen. So what kind of material cannot go across the cell membrane? What kind of material can't go across the cell membrane? Yeah, polar compounds. Could you give me an example of a polar compound? Glucose is a polar compound. Water is a polar compound. Okay, that's not the ones I'm fishing for. I'm fishing for some ions, like sodium and potassium chloride, calcium, for instance. These can't go across the cell membrane. What else have you learned about these ions, and what do they confer to the cell? What do they give the cell the ability to do? Okay, yeah, energy, because a cell can act like a battery because these ions have electrical charges. All right, so they give the cell electrical activity. And when ions move across the cell membrane via these channels, that changes the electrical activity of the cell. And that's really kind of the whole basis of this chapter. All right, so the electrical activity of this neuron right here can be controlled by what we call ligand-gated channels. That means that they can open up or maybe they can close when something binds to them, like, for instance, another neurotransmitter. When it binds to, so a neurotransmitter in that case is going to be a ligand, that can open or close a channel, that's going to change the electrical property of the cell. All right, so dendrites and the cell body have ligand-gated channels. But the axons don't have ligand-gated channels. They have voltage-gated channels. So depending on the voltage that the cell is experiencing, these channels might be opened or closed, which then will further influence what the electrical activity of the cell. So axons conduct impulses away from the cell body because they have voltage-gated channels. So at least from this slide, you should be aware that there are special channels in the membrane, two different classes. And one class is a ligand-gated channel, meaning it's going to listen for a chemical signal, and then it's going to change the permeability of the membrane to an ion. The other kind of channel is a voltage-gated channel, which means that it's going to be aware of the voltage across the cell membrane, and it's going to change its state depending on that voltage. All right, so what kind of channel do these dendrites have? Ligand-gated channels. What kind of channels does this axon have right here? Voltage-gated channels. And probably in about a week, you'll have a really good feel for what that really means. You probably don't right at the moment, but that's okay. I want to introduce that topic to you. Okay, so the long axon length necessitates two special kinds of transport mechanisms for material to move from the cell body all the way down to the synaptic terminal right here, and of course maybe even backwards in the reverse direction. All right, the first one is what we call axoplasmic flow. The second one is what we call axonal transport. Axoplasmic flow moves soluble compounds. That means something has to be in solution, so it's got to be a small molecule. It can't be an organelle, right, or a vesicle filled with something, but something that's dissolved in solution, and it's just going to be pushed down to the nerve endings via rhythmic contractions of the axon. Right, so the axon actually has a little bit of something that you can consider like peristalsis. Where did you understand peristalsis first to take place? For instance, in the digestive tract, right, moving material through the digestive tract just by squishing of the constricting of the walls of the intestines. All right, so kind of think of that model in your mind for moving things down to the axon terminus. Axonal transport is a little bit different than axoplasmic flow because axonal transport requires microtubules. And if maybe you look at a picture of an axon sometime, they might even draw in microtubules. And what's one way that you could think of a microtubule for transport? What's a model in your mind you could think of? Yeah, it's like a monorail. So there are special proteins that can grab onto a microtubule and be transported along a microtubule, and on that transporter molecule, it can attach other large macromolecules or even organs or vesicles. Okay, so along what a microtubule, that movement can be bidirectional. It can move from the cell body down to the axon terminus, or it can actually go from the axon terminus back up to the cell body. And we give those two different names. All right. Anterograde transport moves materials away from the cell body. Anterograde sort of means in the forward direction. All right. So forward direction is when you're walking forward. That's anterograde. So anterograde, by this definition, is from the cell body, which has most of the machinery of a neuron down to the axon terminus. And those motor proteins are called kinesins that allow for anterograde transport. Retrograde means what? Retrograde means going backwards. That requires a little bit different protein. It's very, very similar. I would guess they look very similar. They attach to the microtubule in similar ways, but it works in reverse, and that's a dynein molecule. So kinesins are anterograde, dynein's are for retrograde flow. Okay, so some viruses and toxins can even enter the central nervous system that way, all right, hopping a ride on this dynein kind of motor protein that takes it from the tip of an axon into the cell body of that particular neuron. And does anybody recall from anatomy, and if this even occurs, do you have neurons, or at least the tips of axons or axon terminals, dangling outside your body anywhere where anybody that comes by can grab hold of them? Okay, I think I heard an answer over there. For instance, that's right, those olfactory nerves. Where do those olfactory nerves go? They go right through the cribriform plate, right of the ethmoid bone, through those olfactory foramina, right down into your nasal cavity, and they're just surrounded by some mucus, but they're actually dangling outside your body. And actually, there are some pathogens that can actually access your brain via those nerves that are dangling down inside your nasal cavity. It's very rare to get any of those kinds of infections, but it can happen in Southern California because this is a place where lakes never freeze, and so this kind of pathogen can hang out, say, in Lake Elsinore or whatever, and every 10 years or something, somebody dies of one of these infections because they're out water skiing and they get all that water up in their nose, and those particles then have access to that person's central nervous system. Okay. All right, so functional classification. Here we see, we still see two kinds of neurons. All right, but we can break neurons down into sensory. What's another name for sensory? That is afferent, and a motor is efferent because it's going to produce some kind of effect. And then we have association neurons. Where do we find association neurons? Inside the central nervous system, right? So we have motor neurons that leave the central nervous system. We have sensory or afferent neurons that enter the central nervous system. So those two kinds of neurons are partly where? Partly in the peripheral nervous system, partly in the central nervous system. But what is the kind of neuron that is completely contained within the central nervous system? That is the association or interneuron. All right. So even in your brain, you have interneurons that are sharing information and making decisions on what to do with that information. Okay. Here are the three kinds of neurons, right? The unipolar, which is sensory. Here's the bipolar, which is for special senses. And then here is the multipolar neuron. Okay, for instance, here are some examples. Okay, support cells. So I'm done talking about some of the general aspects of neurons. All right, so make that just a background. You should really be familiar with that already. Pretty much the same thing with neuroglia cells. And when you start to think of neuroglia cells, think of two locations, central nervous system versus peripheral nervous system. And here we have a type of neuroglia cell right here we call a Schwann cell. And these are in the peripheral nervous system only. And it kind of looks like a roll of toilet paper wrapped around an axon of a motor neuron right here. And the lipid material in these layers, which we call the myelin sheath, is called myelin. And this just prevents current leaks from leaking out of the axon while it's sending an electrical signal. So it acts like insulation around the neuron. So the Schwann cell, we see peripheral nervous system. And when the axon has a myelin sheath around it, it speeds up the rate of conduction of electrical impulses from the cell body down to the axon terminus. So that's the job of this Schwann cell right here. And we have little nodes between Schwann cells that we call nodes of Ranvier. And so if this axon was not myelinated, an electrical signal would have to move molecule by molecule by molecule down an axon, which would be relatively slow. But because it's myelinated, electrical signals can actually hop from one node of Ranvier to another, speeding up the conduction. All right, I'll mention that again. So that's the job of the Schwann cell. This part right here that contains the cytoplasm of a Schwann cell, that's what we call the neurolemma of that particular Schwann cell. And this is what the myelin sheath. You know what? I didn't mention another important region within a neuron, like this multipolar neuron right here, and it's going to be really important, and that is the junction between the axon and the cell body right here. And we call that, and it kind of looks like a funnel, and I would actually like for you to think of it as a funnel, because it's funneling information into the axon. We call that the axon hillock. That's going to be a very important functional point in neurons when we look at that. I forgot to mention that. The other kind of neuroglia cell that we see in the peripheral nervous system are satellite cells, and those we find surrounding nerve cell bodies of unipolar neurons in the dorsal root ganglia. They just surround the whole nerve cell body, and so they kind of look like satellites moving around those somas of those nerve cells. Okay. All right, so this is how a Schwann cell does its job. It just starts to wrap itself more and more and more and more around an axon terminus. And so this myelin sheath acts as insulation that you would find on a common wire that you would have in your house, right, that you plug in your refrigerator or toaster. Would you ever consider using an electrical cord that did not have insulation around it? No, because you might be able to plug it in, but you would never be able to unplug it without getting electrocuted, right? All right. So that's not quite the job that these Schwann cells are providing. They just speed up the rate of transmission of electrical impulses, but they do insulate as well. They speed it up via that property of insulation. All right, so here are the cells of the central nervous system, the neuroglia cells anyway, and we can see some cells that line the ventricles right here, and these are what we call ependymal cells. So things that are in the cerebral spinal fluid don't have direct access to the brain, right? Because what would happen to you if any kind of metabolic disturbance happened to these neurons right here? What would happen to you? Your consciousness would be altered, right? Or you might even die. So it's the job of these ependymal cells right here to protect the neurons that are actually inside the brain tissue. Another kind of cell, the microglia cells right here. What's the function of microglia cell? Anybody remember? Microglia, it's an immunological cell. It fights infection. It fights tumors that are in the brain. All right, so anything that these microglia recognize as being foreign to your brain, it tries to destroy, right, including tumors if they have the right kind of antigens. If a microglia cell can recognize a tumor, then of course you're not going to come down with cancer. But some cancers can evade these microglia, and then a person has trouble with brain cancer. All right, there's another kind of cell that acts very much like a Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system, and it's called an oligodendrocyte. It can wrap itself around axons right here, and so it acts as insulation. It always also speeds up the rate of electrical impulses down an axon, but an oligodendrocyte doesn't just pertain to one cell. It can wrap itself around numerous locations on one axon and even neighboring cells. It has many processes. Yeah. Okay, but remember now in the central nervous system, we don't have any Schwann cells whatsoever. So these oligodendrocytes are really taking the place of the Schwann cells in the central nervous system. And their function is very similar. It speeds up the rate of impulse conduction down an axon. All right? And, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, oligodendrocyte wraps around the axon.
Yeah, so see here's an oligodendrocyte. And it has many processes coming off of it, and each one of these processes can go to a different axon and wrap itself around these different axons. And so it's like what? It's just like a hyper-complex kind of Schwann cell because it has many processes. All right, and the myelin, maybe somebody knows if there is a difference between myelin in the peripheral nervous system compared to the central nervous system. I suppose I wouldn't be too surprised if there is a difference, but you don't have to consider any. Do you know if there is or not? Is that what you're, did you have a comment on that, or? Oh, okay, the number of layers is different? Yeah, okay. But functionally, it should be the same. Okay, just speeds the rate of conduction in there. And So the timing of how information is passed within the brain is very critical. And sometimes these oligodendrocytes are destroyed by a person's immune system, unfortunately, and their brains become unmyelinated, or it becomes demyelinating. And it's not a rare kind of disease process. That's what we call multiple sclerosis. And it just wrecks the timing of how signals are transmitted in somebody's brain. It's And it's mostly manifest by motor disorders, but it could be also manifest with cognitive disorders that somebody has. And it can go away and come back. It can be recurrent. And so, of course, that's always the goal of medicine, right, is to delay the reoccurrence as soon as far as possible into the future. Okay, we don't really know how to cure the disease, but some people can actually live fairly normal lives with multiple sclerosis right now. Okay, so that's the job of these oligodendrocytes. Let's talk about some others. Astrocytes, right here. And you can see a lot of processes with this astrocyte. Some of them are around capillary right here. And some of the processes on that same cell then reach over to the cell body or dendrite or axon hillock of a neuron. And so the astrocyte has a number of different kinds of functions that we're going to look at. But one is that it can act like a bridge for important nutrients, right, from the blood into a neuron right here. So for instance, maybe transport a glucose from the blood, or even maybe, glucose would be a really good example. Okay, so it acts like a nice bridge. Since it's also, these perivascular feet are surrounding the capillary, the brain is protected, just like the brain is protected from material in the CSF, the brain is protected from compounds that are in the blood. There's something called blood-brain barrier. It's a special barrier that prevents things that are in the blood from entering the brain, and sometimes that's an unwanted difficulty because maybe we can design a pharmaceutical agent, say, maybe to combat multiple sclerosis, but maybe that drug is not going to go across the blood-brain barrier, so it's not going to have any beneficial effect for the person. So sometimes the blood-brain barrier is helpful, sometimes we have to figure out ways around it. And we believe that these astrocytes here play an important role in forming the blood-brain barrier, which is what normally very protective and maintains the health of the brain. All right, so those are the functions of the glial cells. Axon regeneration. I wonder how that slide got there. Okay. Let's talk about axon regeneration for just a little bit. It occurs more readily in the peripheral nervous system compared to the central nervous system. All right. So in terms of neuroglia cells, what's a difference that you already have in your mind between CNS and PNS? What's the difference? You have Schwann cells. Where do you have Schwann cells? Peripheral nervous system, and you have oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system, and that's the reason why the peripheral nervous system heals or can regenerate axons much better compared to the central nervous systems, because oligodendrocytes produce proteins that inhibit regrowth because they form a glial scar. They scar up, all right, instead of, and that scar blocks the regrowth of a neuron. So when you have a spinal cord injury, does the spinal cord regenerate? No, because it's part of the central nervous system and there are oligodendrocytes there. Okay, as opposed to peripheral nervous system where we have what kind of cells? Schwann cells. So if there is damage to an axon, okay, what regenerates first are these Schwann cells, right? They grow and they actually form a tube, right, which we call a regeneration tube. And this regeneration tube might even secrete some kind of compounds, trophic factors that guide and stimulate the regrowth of that axon to this effector organ right here. That does not happen in the central nervous system. So Schwann cells can create a regeneration tube, but oligodendrocytes cannot. So that can happen in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so there's a lot of times, even in the central nervous system, we think that the brain we have right now, since the cells really don't divide by mitosis, are the cells that we had 5 years ago or that we will have with any luck in 10 years or 20 years from now, right? So our brain is pretty static. And that's pretty much true. But recently, we've really had to change our opinion around quite a bit. And I guess I would ask you something about your skeletal system, maybe as an example. Is the skeletal system you have right now anything like the skeletal system you had 6 years ago? You're going to say no, because bone is really what? It's a living tissue, has osteocytes in there, and every 5 years you completely rebuild and remodel your skeletal system, right? And if you start physical activity, your bones are going to remodel, get bigger and stronger in those areas that are experiencing stress, right? So as a matter of fact, that's why we always recommend what to protect yourself from osteoporosis. Exercise, right? Because when you exercise a bone, it gets bigger and stronger. And of course, you have to have the proper diet so that you can have calcium to put into those bones. What about a muscle? If you start exercising a muscle, what's going to happen to that muscle? It's going to get bigger and stronger as well. All right, so what I want to impress upon you is that when you use your brain, guess what happens to your brain? All right, in a sense, it gets bigger and stronger as well. It remodels itself just like muscles do and bones do. All right, and this is really something new. We call that the plasticity of the brain. It grows, especially when you take a hard class like maybe microbiology. Your brain is really growing and rearranging itself. Maybe not so much in a class like this, but for sure in a micro class. Okay, so that's one of the reasons why sometimes the beginning part of the class is a lot harder than the end part of the class. Because your brain is just learning how to learn that new kind of information. And sometimes classes get easier even though the material gets harder, all right, toward the end of the class. All right, so there are things that we call neurotrophins. Neurotrophins are secreted by those astrocytes that cause brain to actually develop. Maybe not the production of new cells, but it's going to tell dendrites and axons to form new connections between neighboring cells. So the network gets more complex. You might have the same number of cells, but the network expands. Information can be transmitted more efficiently between the same neurons that you've always had. All right, so neurotrophins are very important for fetal nerve growth during development. It's even important for survival of many adult neurons that we have in our bodies. And it's even important for regeneration. And then there's one part of the brain called the hippocampus. And we found that people that are depressed are, clinical depression, are depleted of these neurotrophins. All right? So somebody that's depressed is not able to learn and respond to new challenging things in their environment, unfortunately. All right? And the hippocampus actually regresses. And with antidepressant therapy, we see that the hippocampus actually comes back to its normal size and growth, and that can stimulate the growth of these neurons, and somebody is what, able to learn and handle new stressful situations in their environment. That's one way to look at clinical depression. Yeah. Okay. Ask me that again. Okay, under what conditions can you never learn anything new?
Like
right now?
Yeah.
Your brain has to change its structure in order for you to learn something new. Okay. Yeah, so when you learn something new, your brain is actually changing itself. It's making more connections. In a normal individual, with a proper diet, right, and as long as the stressful situation isn't too stressful, right, because everybody has their limit, of course. So in order to learn things, your brain actually has to be changing. And when I look out in this class, I just see all your brains just going wild out there. It's amazing. So thanks for trusting me enough to mess with your brains like that. All right? So be careful on who you trust of putting information in there, because your brain is changing. So as a matter of fact, just as kind of as an aside, what do human brains like to do more than anything else? Eat. Okay, well, your body likes to eat, and in a sense, the brain likes to eat. This is true. But the brain actually likes to learn more than anything else. And I didn't hear too much moaning and groaning out there, but brains are actually designed to learn. All right, and brains really don't know what the good things are to learn or the bad things, and that actually has some ramifications on how we treat patients. So for instance, epilepsy is where there is some electrical activity in the brain that causes motor dysfunction in some part of your body to where you can't control it, right? An epileptic fit or seizure. All right, and since the brain loves to learn things, guess what happens when somebody has an epileptic seizure? The brain actually does what? It learns how to have an epileptic seizure, which of course we know is not a very good thing, right? I couldn't give a lecture if I had a seizure or couldn't drive home or something like that. So it's very important, as soon as somebody has a seizure, what do we do for that person? Make sure that what happens? It never happens again, because what happens if it happens again? The brain learns even more how to produce an epileptic seizure. All right, so it's very important to treat people with seizure activity very aggressively so the brain doesn't automatically learn how to do that. All right, and we now know that that's the same for many kind of diseases, and clinical depression is another one of these things where the brain learns how to become depressed. All right, and so it's easier for somebody with clinical depression to experience a second episode compared to somebody that has never had depression before. So again, that's another disease process that should be treated very aggressively, because the brain is rebuilding itself and remodeling itself. So that's an idea we didn't really have 10 or 15 years ago on how to treat patients, because the brain is just so wonderful at learning things. It's good at learning good things and bad things. And fortunately, you choose all the good things to put in there. Yeah. Plasticity is a term that's used to describe how the brain can actually change its structure, and then it changes its function as a result of that. All right. So, but the underlying theme is changing of structure, so it's a way of learning. All right. It's a way of learning and becoming more familiar with your environment. All right. So here's that astrocyte. Yeah. Can you lose them? Sure, you're just like your bones, right? If you stop exercising, they will atrophy. If you stop using your brain, then, you know, you lose function in the brain. I don't know if anybody understands learning theory extremely well at a molecular level or at a psychological level, but I've heard, what are some of the best ways that you can use to keep your brain young and learning and making connections? It is practicing and using language skills, learning new languages. Okay, that's probably one of the best ways to keep your brain young. Probably learning new musical instruments. And probably mathematics is really good too, because mathematics is just what? It's just a form of language. Okay, so that's what will keep your brains young. So right now, your brains probably feel real tired, but you're really doing what? You're trying to keep them young and keeping them plastic, right, and so that they can learn new things. All right, so that's the job of this astrocyte right here. It helps adjust potassium levels, right? It can recycle neurotransmitters. So for instance, if here is an axon and here's the axon terminus, this electrical signal can't hop into this neuron right here. And you might be already familiar, this neuron right here we call the presynaptic neuron. Did you learn that in anatomy? I can't recall. I believe so. All right, so here is the synaptic cleft, and then here is the postsynaptic cell. So electrical information can't jump from the presynaptic cell into the postsynaptic cell, because if it did, it would be like a lightning bolt in there, right? And we don't have any lightning bolts inside our bodies. So how is that information transferred from the presynaptic cell into the postsynaptic cell? It's via a chemical signal, which is a neurotransmitter, and in this case, does it say? Yeah, it even says that in this case, that neurotransmitter is glutamate, right? When glutamate is released from the presynaptic cell, goes to the postsynaptic cell, and then that causes the establishment of another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. Right? Now, this glutamate that's released into the synaptic cleft can keep stimulating the postsynaptic cell over and over and over again, right, for days. But would you like that to happen? No, you would like the activity of glutamate to be short-lived, right? And what helps decrease the activity or the stimulus from glutamate is that it can be taken up by the astrocyte out of the synaptic cleft, thereby reducing the length of time that it is free in the synaptic cleft over here to cause synaptic transmission to occur. So that's another job of the astrocyte. It regulates neurogenesis by releasing neurotrophins. One important kind of neurotrophin is called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, and that's implicated in learning. Okay. And the astrocyte is also important for the blood-brain barrier, forming the blood-brain barrier. All right, so that takes us to the next topic in this chapter, and that is membrane potential. So let's just review. What the heck does that potential mean? It's what is a potential? It means energy, right? And you actually could think of what? What kind of energy? You could think of like potential energy. Maybe that's where this term actually comes from. Potential also means voltage, and not just voltage, but a voltage difference. There's going to be a gradient of voltage. There's going to be a separation of charge. And what is really a gradient? Especially, or even with electrical charge. If there's a gradient of electrical charge, like what is it? It is energy, right? It can give something the ability to do work. And that's what we have in our pockets. We have batteries in our pockets for our cell phones and things like that. And that gives your telephone the ability to do work. Okay? And cells operate that same way. All right, so there is something called RMP. I think we might be familiar with that already. So and that's resting membrane potential. So potential, think of voltage on the outside of the cell compared to the inside of the cell. At rest, all cells have what? A negative internal charge compared to the outside, right? And an unequal distribution of ions. Like, for instance, what can you tell me about sodium? Where is it high? Where is potassium high? Yeah? So we got outside, inside. What about chlorine? Where is it high? Outside. And where is calcium high? Outside. Right. Okay, and don't forget, these ions want to move down their electrochemical gradient. What side of the membrane is in resting cell is more negative? That's the inside. So sodium wants to rush inside the cell because of the concentration gradient, but also because of what? The electrical gradient as well are going to want to draw sodium in. Now, why can't sodium get inside the cell? Because the channels are not open, right? It can't get through the plasma membrane because sodium is hydrophilic and the membrane is hydrophobic. So it needs some kind of channel to get inside the cell. Furthermore, there are pumps that are pumping sodium out all the time, the sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, so that kind of describes the resting membrane potential. Large cations. You know what? You might want to say large anions right here, okay? Because the large proteins can't get through the cell membrane. Those are anions. That's really what makes the cell on the inside negative, because an anion, what kind of charge does an anion have? A negative charge, right? Okay. All right. All right, so cells are excitable. Cells can discharge their resting membrane potential quickly by rapid changes in permeability to ions. So the permeability of these various ions can change across the membrane, and that's going to be due to opening of specific channels for these particular ions. All right, so neurons and muscles do this to generate and conduct electrical impulses. So we're going to start to look and see how that exactly happens. All right, so membrane potential changes. Okay, we can measure a membrane potential by taking a voltmeter, or maybe we have a little bit more money and we actually went and bought one of these things. This is what we would call an oscilloscope, right? But basically it's just a fancy voltmeter that you can actually visualize voltage instead of just getting a number from. And how many terminals does a battery have? You've got two. That's right. All batteries have two terminals. And so you can measure the difference in voltage between any two places, right, on a battery, those two terminals. So you need what we call two electrodes on any voltmeter, and those you have to place on the terminals. The terminals of a cell are what? The inside of the cell compared to the outside of the cell. Those are the two corresponding terminals. So one electrode we have to put inside the cell, and the other we have to leave outside the cell. And do you think it would be really difficult to make these electrodes right here? A little electrode to put inside the cell? Well, because cells are microscopic, they're really, really small. But I've made hundreds of these electrodes. They're really not hard to make at all. You just get some glass tubing, okay, and then you start to pull it apart. How can you pull a glass tube apart? You heat it up with a Bunsen burner until it kind of turns into a liquid, but before it drops off, you just pull it really fast, and then it shrinks down and then eventually breaks. And where it breaks is actually a little microscopic tube, just like the piece of glass tube that you started with, except what? It's microscopically small. And then you just fill that tube with a salt solution, right? And salt is filled with charged particles, so it can carry electricity, no problem. And then with a microscope, then you just insert that little glass tube right inside the cell. So it becomes what they call like a micropipette. So it's pretty easy to make it, but you got to be careful with those things. Why do you have to be careful with those little glass tubes? Because they're sharp, they're microscopic, you can't see them. But because you can't see them, it doesn't mean that if you poke yourself, it doesn't go inside you, right? So you got to be really careful where you point that thing. And what about glass that's inside your body? It really doesn't go away, it just stays there, right? So you got to be careful with those things. All right, so those are those little electrodes that you can make. All right, and now you can measure the voltage on the inside of the cell compared to the outside of the cell right here. All right, and if this is a living cell, it's not going to read zero. So here we have a voltage scale in millivolts. Here is zero. So going positive is in the upward direction. And then on the left-right axis, this is just a time axis. So this is just a plot of voltage versus time of this particular cell right here. And the normal cell, when it's at rest, produces RMP, and we see it's going to be about what? Minus 70. So it's not zero, right? It's less than zero, it's minus 70. That's resting membrane potential. And we can change the electricity or the battery nature of the cell. We can get the resting membrane potential to deviate from minus up to zero. So what's happening to the nature of the battery when it's going from minus 70 to zero? Is it becoming more polarized or less polarized? Yeah, it's going to zero. The polarization is going away. So because of that, we say that it is depolarizing. Right? The cell is depolarizing. The charge gradient is going away. And that's what we're going to call stimulation. When we stimulate a nerve, that's what happens. It does what? It depolarizes. Okay? Furthermore, this resting membrane potential, we could do something to the cell, and we can get the potential to actually move farther away from zero. So what's happening? The battery is actually getting stronger. It's getting stronger when that happens. We call that, I have no chance of seeing this. This is what we call hyperpolarization. Okay, hyperpolarization. And there's something else right here. What does that say? That is, does that say inhibition? Oh, very good. Okay, that inhibits the cell. So depolarizing is a stimulation, and a hyperpolarization is an inhibiting of the neuron. So furthermore, there's one last thing. If we start at resting membrane potential and depolarize the neuron, we stimulate it. And then if we stop the stimulation, it's going to go back to resting membrane potential. So when it goes back to resting membrane potential, we just call that repolarization. All right, so moving away from RMP in the positive direction is depolarization. Moving away from RMP by increasing the voltage, that's hyperpolarization. But after we depolarize and let the membrane potential go back to RMP, that's what we call repolarization. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, we're going to see how that happens. We're going to see how that happens. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, we just say that it is no longer hyperpolarized. Okay. Yeah. Somebody might have some terminology, but I've never had to use that terminology. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. When we get into the cardiac chapter, after we're done with neurons, everything that we learn about neurons here, the electrical properties of neurons, we'll be able to apply to the electrical properties of muscles and the electrical properties of the myocardium as well. So yes, we're very electrical beings. All of our tissues have electricity associated with them. Yeah. Ah, because the EKG doesn't measure one cell. It measures millions and millions of cells that are acting in a kind of a unified dance. And so we could put electrodes inside one myocardial cell if we wanted to measure something about that one cell, but usually we're interested about how the whole heart is operating. And the whole heart, when all those millions of cells, all those millions of batteries at the same time are producing electricity, we can just measure that right on the surface of your body. And it's a fairly large voltage.
So
yeah, with surface, we call those surface electrodes. You know, if somebody wants a really sophisticated kind of electrocardiogram, they do put electrodes around the heart. That would be a multi-lead ECG. Oh, are you an ECG technician? No, you'd use many, many leads. Okay. Yeah, it just kind of goes around the heart. A lot of times we can get by with just putting a couple of electrodes on our wrists and our ankles. And when we do that with four electrodes, we can get what we call two leads. Okay. Two of the numerous leads on the heart. So it all depends on what kind of electrical activity in the heart you want to look at. Okay. All right, but let's start with, now instead of a whole organ, let's just start a little bit more simply, which is just what? One cell. Okay, so in terms of changing the electrical properties of a cell, we see what? We see depolarization and we see repolarization. And then this hyperpolarization we'll talk about too just a little bit. Okay. All right, so membrane potential, that's just the voltage across the cell membrane. Changes occur by what? The flow of these little molecules called ions, because an ion is charged, and when it's in motion, it's a current, right? When they flow through membrane channels, they can't normally flow through a membrane channel or through a membrane unless there's a channel that's open. Some channels are normally open and some channels are normally closed. You'll get a feel for which ones are excitatory, which ones are stimulatory. For instance, a potassium channel, this is a leak channel, they're pretty much always open. Closed channels have molecular gates that can be opened or closed depending on the circumstances. One kind is a voltage-gated channel. They're opened by depolarization. And remember way back when we were looking a few slides back, what part of the neuron has voltage-gated channels? That is the axon, for instance, have voltage-gated channels. All right, so let's go back to our oscilloscope. So a voltage-gated channel is going to remain closed when the cell voltage is at resting membrane potential. But as soon as the membrane potential starts to depolarize, that means go to zero, all right, those electrical charges change the environment of that particular protein. And as the voltage changes, all right, then the protein is going to change conformation. As the voltage changes, well, what would happen if I took some electricity with a cord and put it on your side? What would happen to you? Oh, you'd change conformation, right? So when the voltage changes across the membrane, that's going to cause a conformation in those membrane proteins, and they're going to open up, right? Just due to that change in voltage. These voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in resting cells, and the sodium channels, they're closed in resting cells as well. Okay, so here is a pretty nice model to think of these two kinds of channels that we're most interested in, and that is a sodium channel and a potassium channel. So here is a channel that's closed, right, and here is the phospholipid bilayer. So can sodium or potassium move across this membrane right here? Even though it might want to because of a chemical gradient or electrical gradient, it might want to move, but it can't because this channel is closed. All right, but if we change the voltage on the membrane, we might change the conformation of this protein. All of a sudden it opens up, and so now there is a way for ions to move from one side of the membrane to the other. All right, and then there is a second component to this membrane channel, And this is what we call an inactivation gate. So here is a little side channel or side chain of a protein, and this little protein can plug up the channel even though it is open. So maybe the channel protein has the conformation to allow movement of ions, right? If this inactivation gate closes the channel, what happens? Then these ions can't move back and forth across the membrane. So you got a way to control the opening and closing of this channel, but you can also plug it up with something we call the inactivation gate. Is that on here anywhere? Inactivation gate? Channel inactivated by inactivation gate. Okay. All right, so let's look at something called an action potential. Okay. So let's break that term down again. What does potential mean? It means a voltage across the membrane. And what does action mean? What can you tell me about that voltage? It's going to, what's action about it? Constant, stationary. Action means it's going to change, right? It's going to vary. It's going to go up or down or something like that. So an action potential is what? Some activity with the membrane voltage across the cell. Yeah. Depolarization, the inside becomes more positive. It loses negativity. Yeah, let's take a look. Here's that oscilloscope. So starting here at resting membrane potential, it's minus 70. When it depolarizes, it actually goes from minus 70 to what? Minus 60, minus 50, minus 40. It's on its way to zero. And it actually might even go positive. It might go past zero and become positive. That's what we call depolarization.
I'm trying to understand, when it goes to depolarization, the channel's open, right?
Channel's open, depolarization takes place. I will show you what happens. I will show you some of that stuff. And there is a nice, easy way to think about that. Okay? So that's what we're going to start to look at now. Why do ion currents change the electrical state of the membrane potential? And if the membrane potential is changing, we call that an action potential. Okay? Action potential is one of the first ones we're going to start to look at. Action potentials are due to voltage-gated channels. All right? And you'll become familiar with that in a couple of days. All right, so here is what's happening with and action potential. So we're going to compare these two diagrams right here. All right, so let's just say that there is a stimulus. And a stimulus is, as opposed to an inhibitory event, a stimulus is always going to cause depolarization. All right, stimulus is going to cause depolarization. Yeah. Oh, I sure do. I got it right here. I think we have enough time to pass it around. Yeah, don't lollygag too much with it. Pass it around. Sign it. Pass it around real fast. Okay? But sign it in the right spot. Okay. All right, so a depolarizing stimulus is going to change the resting membrane potential from where to where. It's going to cause the membrane potential to decrease, to go from minus 70 up to zero. And there is a membrane protein, okay, that is sensitive to that voltage across the cell membrane to where it's going to open up when the voltage changes from minus 70 to, say, minus 50. The protein is going to change conformation. And that is a sodium gate. It's a voltage-regulated sodium gate on the cell membrane. All right? Now, when that sodium gate opens up, what happens to sodium? Where is sodium high? On the outside of the cell, right? And where is, and what about, how do electrical charges attract each other? What kind of electrical charges attract each other? Opposite, right? So positive charges will neutralize negative charges. All right, and you have sodium high on the outside of the cell. So it's going to want to run into the cell because of the concentration gradient, but it also wants to run into the cell because why? The inside of the cell is negative. So as soon as you open this sodium channel right here. It's a gated channel. It's not open all the time. It's open when the cell starts to depolarize. Guess what happens? Sodium diffuses into the cell. It just rushes in. Is that active or passive? It is just a passive process, right? It's going from high concentration to low. It's going from an area of high charge to an area of negative charge. Sodium floods into the cell, and as sodium goes into the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It's normally negative, but as positive charges rush into the cell, the inside of the cell becomes more positive. So it's losing the polarity of the cell. So just by sodium entering the cell, we call that depolarization. That produces depolarization. Okay. So as the cell changes voltage even more, that's going to cause more sodium gates to open, which causes what? More sodium to enter the cell, which then depolarizes the cell even more, which causes more sodium gates to open, which depolarizes the cell even more. So what kind of feedback loop does that look like? That's a positive feedback loop. So here's a really good example of a positive feedback mechanism that happens under normal circumstances, and that's very important. All right, so let's look at a plot of membrane potential versus time of this depolarizing event that I talked about. So minus 70 is, what do we call minus 70? That is, that's RMP, right? And then if we somehow inject some kind of positivity inside the cell, right, that is going to depolarize the cell, right? If that's depolarizing, we call that a stimulus. When it reaches a certain point right here, this is what we call a threshold. At this threshold, that is where the voltage-gated channels are set to open up, right at this threshold. Right, so a stimulating depolarization may not cause an action potential, but if the stimulus is sufficient to reach threshold, that's going to cause many sodium voltage-gated sodium channels to open. Sodium is going to enter the cell, and what's going to happen to the membrane potential of the cell as sodium rushes in? Yeah, it's going to become more positive, right? It's going to lose its negativity. So this is what we call depolarization, sodium moving in. All right, and then you can see that goes all the way up to about plus 30, so the polarity of the membrane switches all together, and then that sodium channel closes. It slams shut. Now, can you tell me what might be happening right here at the peak of this thing is what we call an action potential? What happens? Right at the peak, all right, this inactivation gate, even though the channel is still open, this inactivation gate slams into the opening right here, and it stops any further movement of sodium into the cell. And when that happens, all right, the cell can no longer depolarize. It stops depolarizing because of that inactivation gate. All right, but there are actually two important voltage-gated channels on a cell. One is sodium, and the other is potassium right here. All right, both are triggered into opening right here at when the stimulus reaches threshold, but the potassium channels are slower to open. They just operate more slowly than the sodium channels. All right, so now after depolarization, the potassium channels open, and where do you have potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell. So they want to diffuse outside the cell because of a concentration gradient. And right here, now what can you tell me about the inside of the cell? It is now positive compared to the outside. So the outside is actually now negative, and that negative charge on the outside of the cell is going to do what for potassium? It's going to help force it outside the cell. So now potassium sees that electrochemical gradient forcing potassium out of the cell, and when potassium leaves the cell, what happens to membrane potential? As positive charges leave, the inside becomes more negative, and this is what we call repolarization as potassium leaves the cell. Okay, so you got depolarization and followed by repolarization because the potassium channels are slower. And you should get a feel for why these ions move in those two directions. And it's caused by, it's controlled by just the voltage across the membrane as to whether those channels open or close. Right, and the peak right here is due to that inactivation gate. But since the potassium channels are slower to open, they're also slower to close. Right, and since they're slow to close, this region right here, you still have a lot of potassium channels open, so potassium continues to leave the cell, and as potassium leaves the cell, it creates this overshoot, right, which we call, what do we call this overshoot right here? This is hyperpolarization. That's hyperpolarization, because those potassium channels are slow to close. All right, so if we look at this, the blue square over here, the depolarizing stimulus causes the potassium voltage-gated channels to open, but these are slow, so that doesn't happen until after depolarization. All right, and then potassium diffuses out of the cell. That makes the cell less depolarized, making it, what, more negative back inside the cell, and the cell goes back to resting membrane potential. So because the voltages are changing on the cell membrane, we call this an action potential. An action potential as opposed to resting membrane potential. What's resting membrane potential? That's just right down over here. That's just a constant voltage. Okay, yeah. When it hyperpolarizes, here. Oh, now what happens right here? Let's look at this. I'll say something about that right now. We got time. What is the magnitude of the stimulus that can cause this action potential the first time right here? If RMP is at minus 70, what does this threshold look like? It looks like it's what? Let's just say minus, yeah, it looks like 55. Let's just say 60 for round numbers, right? So the stimulus has to be at 10 millivolts to reach threshold, right? So that's just the distance from minus 70 to minus 60 right here, a 10 millivolt stimulus. But now over here, what does the stimulus have to be? It can't be 10 millivolts because that'd only take it up to here, and would it reach threshold? It wouldn't, so that stimulus wouldn't cause an action potential. The stimulus now has to be greater. It has to be more like 15 millivolts. So this area right here, is this hyperpolarization, just prevents another action potential from coming along, right? We call this a refractory period. It's what we call a relative refractory period. It could be overcome, but the stimulus that overcomes it has to be greater than the initial stimulus. All right, so this is what we call the relative refractory period. I'll mention that again, but since you asked, this is a pretty good time to talk about it. All right, let me just read what I got here. So action potential is a wave of a membrane potential change that sweeps along an axon from axon hillock to synapse. So in that part of the neuron between an axon hillock and the synapse, what kind of channels are in the cell membrane? The voltage-gated channels. So an axon has voltage-gated channels, and only in an axon do we have action potentials. We do not have action potentials in dendrites and cell bodies because dendrites and cell bodies don't have voltage-gated channels in the membrane. So they can't undergo action potentials. There's another kind of thing that happens there that we'll talk about next time. All right, so the wave is formed by rapid depolarization of the membrane by sodium moving in. All right, what do we call that when sodium moves in? Think of that oscilloscope. That is called, sodium moving in is depolarization, all right, followed by rapid movement of potassium out of the cell, which we call repolarization. So there are two main parts to an action potential. There's depolarization and repolarization. And in your mind, you should have a molecular picture of what's causing depolarization. All right, so if somebody says action potentials, what should you automatically think of? How many parts? Two main parts, right? The two main parts are depolarization followed by repolarization. So depolarization is caused by what particular ion? Sodium. And sodium doing what? you should be able to see that pretty easy. Sodium rushes into the cell, electrochemical gradient is pulling it in, followed by the second phase, which is repolarization. And what would you use to explain repolarization? Potassium is leaving the cell because, again, of its electrochemical gradient. Okay, so that's the important thing about this action potential and about where it happens. So I've actually talked about all of this already. Yeah. Yep. And they are? Yeah, because sodium is high on the outside under resting conditions. And what about charge under resting conditions? It's more negative inside the cell in resting conditions. So again, that's drawing sodium into the cell. And what do we call that when sodium rushes in the cell because of the electrochemical gradient? As depolarization. Is that active or passive? That's just passive. That's just opening that gate and sodium is going to flood inside the cell. So your cells are primed to depolarize. Yeah. Yeah, because there's a reversal of charge at the peak of the action potential. Look at the membrane potential is what? It's positive on the inside. And now potassium is high on the inside, low on the outside. It wants to rush out, but it's also positive on the inside, negative on the outside. So again, potassium would like to leave the cell because of the electrochemical gradient. And the concentration gradient also favors it to leave. Yeah, and that's a voltage-gated channel too that opens when the voltage changes on the membrane. Sodium, you know what? Sodium is stopped from moving because of that inactivation gate. So repolarization is due to potassium only. Yeah. So I think we'll start with this slide next time. Where's that sign-in sheet at? Is it going around?